Proverbs 30, verses 18 and 19 says this. Three things are too wonderful for me. Four, I do not understand. The way of an eagle in the sky, the way of a serpent on a rock, the way of a ship on the high seas, and the way of a man with a virgin. Now, that proverb is something of a riddle in and of itself. It doesn't really tell you up front what it means. You have to pick away at it, and even after you do, you maybe don't know. Is he saying that there are three things beyond which a man has understanding? The eagle, the serpent, the ship, and the man? Or is he saying that there's one thing that we really don't understand? The way of a man with a virgin, the way of a young man in his twitterpation, right? He thinks it's love, but it's probably got some lust. She's making eyes at him, and man, is he puppy head over heels, right? That is too wonderful. We cannot understand it. Both in the good and the evil. Like, there is no rhyme nor reason to what he's doing, right? Is it that one thing, and then the other three things are ways of him trying to explain it? That is like unto an eagle in the sky. He's doing what he is made to do. That's the way of a serpent on the rock, that there is a hidden danger there. That the way of the ship on the seas, it's necessary. It's good for society. And yet, again, you mix both eagle and serpent, both power, pleasure, and danger all in one. And this is the way of a man with a virgin, the danger of romance. Is that what Proverbs 30, and I lost the number already, 30 verses 18 and 19 is about? Oh, it's hard to say because it's a riddle. I'll tell you what. You could just shift it a little. You could just strip away the way of a man with a virgin, the way of the ship on the seas, the way of the serpent on the rock, and you could just say it this way. You could say, there is one thing which is too wonderful for me, one which I do not understand, the way of an eagle in the sky in Revelation chapter 8, verse 13. Now, don't get too excited. I mean, I'm not making any promises here. I'm not saying this is going to be any good today. I'm not saying this is going to be close to whatever mojo was working during the earlier Revelation Unleashed stuff. But I'm going to make a run at it. We're going to give it a try. And where we left off was in this verse, which is an interlude between the four trumpets, which are the trumpets being the second set of seven, of three sets of seven, which are the whole format of the book of Revelation, and that this seven trumpets reality is really the heart and the meat of the book itself. It's the majority of the book itself. We left off after four of them. I guess we didn't spend enough time on verse 12. Well, maybe I'll have to think about that and go back. But structurally, between the first four and then the remaining three, you have this odd little verse. It's so odd and it's such a riddle that the ancients actually changed the words of the Bible to try to make it make sense. This is this Revelation 8:13. It says, "Then I looked, and I heard an eagle crying with a loud voice as it flew directly overhead. Woe, woe, woe to those who dwell on the earth, at the blasts of the other trumpets that the three angels are about to blow." Now, I want to come back and talk about the eagle. I mean, this is kind of like the focal point here. But I also want to review here our structure, because it's been quite a while. I went back and listened to the last Raw on Revelation that we've done, or that I did. And I listened, and I was like, holy moly, how could you stop there? And also, holy moly, you still didn't even know what you were talking about. Because it is. It's just, structurally, it's very challenging to try to figure out what's going on. Every pastor worth its salt is going to tell you about the three sevens, right? That you have the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls of wrath, the censers of wrath at the end. That's easy. And if you look at the first seven is pretty straightforward as well. We talked about this, right? You have like the first four are about creation, and then you have salvation working itself out in history toward the end of the world in the latter three. That's the child's play compared to this. So we've talked about this before. I really do recommend, although it is with a grain of salt, the late Lois Brighton's Revelation commentary. You can get the non-scholastic version from Concordia Publishing House. That is, it's pulled out all of the what you might call the metadata of the technical aspects of biblical study, the Greek words in all of their detail. So when someone who's a prof, a doctor, writes a commentary, they have a format they have to follow for the sake of the scholastic world, and it's dense. It's like reading a user manual a little bit. But Concordia Publishing House has done a nice thing. They've pulled a lot of that out, and they've published it just sort of as a popular commentary. It's just him saying what he thinks it means. And I do have to recommend it to you. He taught me how to read this book. I've said this before. My problem with the commentary is that he doesn't always follow his own rules, nor is he always willing to say he doesn't know to go further. So while I will laud him and rely on him, he ultimately, when it comes to this segment here, this question of what about these trumpets, how do they hang together, I just think he misses the boat largely. So that some of these events that take place in the middle, things like the angel who's going to come down and put his feet on the land and on the sea, things like the woman and the dragon, he calls these things excursuses, side points, tangents, as if John just kind of stops the trumpets for a while and then comes back to them. And I don't think that's right at all. I think they're actually the trumpets. And you just have this massive chunk of trumpets in the middle of the book. Okay, so that's what I want to try to wrap our heads around. And we're going to spend, every time I talk about this, until we're done with it, we're going to spend time saying, all right, how do these trumpets function together? How are they a total whole? This is not, it's not scattershot. It can't be scattershot. You know what I mean when I say scattershot? Blunderbuss, right? Blunderbuss is a kind of gun that you just like put like your forks and your knives and your rocks and you put everything in it and then you put some powder on the back end, kind of like a cannon, goes poof, and it just kind of shoots whatever everywhere. It can be quite dangerous up close, but when you can't aim with the thing, right? You can't hit from a distance. And I just refuse to believe that John is just randomly stream of conscious making this scattershot thing. I think that there's meaning behind this. I think that this is code. And hopefully, if you're interested in me going on with the series, I've convinced you of that much, right? That this is code. Okay, well then part of the code is the structure. I mean, if you're going to send a secret message hidden in a letter, right? Count the fourth letter and the seventh letter of each second sentence, and you put it together, and eventually you have like this new sentence, right? You have to have these rules. You have to have this understanding of the structural niceties to put the pieces together. And so to ask first and foremost, what are these three different sevens doing, right, is to start that. And we've talked about this. I think this one's pretty easy, too. I think you're a fool if you don't see this part. You're in hootenanny nonsense. The three sevens are three perspectives on the entirety of the salvific story. They are Genesis to 2 Thessalonians, right, the end of the world, told three different ways from three different angles with three different perspectives. And they build on each other in the way that if you hear a great musical piece, at the very start of it, I'm not talking about rock and roll. I like rock and roll too, but I'm talking about like the classics, like those who were the masters. And frankly, most rock doesn't compare skill-wise. The masters would introduce a theme early in the work, but they wouldn't give it all away. It would be kind of light. It would be a tickle of the theme. And then they'd run away from the theme and they'd do something else, and then they come back, and there it is again, the theme. And then they go away and they come back, and there it is again, the theme. And now it's getting louder. Not louder like forte louder, but louder like you can feel it louder. Like it's more what you're listening to. And they'll do that back and forth and back and forth, until at the very end, that theme is the song. And so that's what I think is going on with these three visions of sevens in Revelation, that what is introduced in the first is now being exposited, expounded on, widened in the second. And the third, again, it's not like it has to get bigger to be louder. In the third set, the censers of wrath, which is the whole thing from fall to salvation, now that it's all been set up, now it just rolls. You know, it's kind of like one. It's weird that movies have done this more than rock and roll, but movies have done this very well. I mean, if I go da 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 da, now, if you saw that movie, you know what I'm doing, right? So that by the time at the very end, when the pirates are walking under the water and the moon is shining on their bones, and it's kind of dun-dun-dun-dun-dun, you're kind of doing that thing, but it's building and it's building and it's building, and so when it comes back, it's da-da-da-da-da-da, you know it's there, right? And you're like, yeah, it doesn't even have to be that long for your blood to just boil with joy. So that's what the third set of sevens is supposed to do. We're in the midst of like him toying with this theme. John's toying with this theme, but I refuse to believe it's not there, right? So this is the argument. I refuse to believe that there is not one theme that he's working with, that this is instead, you know, our influence has been, this comes from the Middle Ages, but it's also just, it's such 18th century nonsense, you know, that this is just it's a blueprint for the end of the world. And if we just understand that prophecy hasn't been fulfilled yet in the death of Jesus, then we can see that the nation state of Israel is really where all this is going to happen at some point, blah, blah, blah. And even for them, the eagle in the sky, I don't know what they're going to do with that thing. But, all right, I am convicted. There is a structure, and this structure then gets narrower, so that when I get to what is this particular seven is going to be an echo that resounds and expands of the original seven. But that means it's got a structure. It doesn't mean they all match up like one-to-one. A Westerner would want that. We'd want like the and this is what I used to try to find a way to make this work, and it just doesn't fit. We're like the first seal is the first trumpet is the first censer of wrath, right? We'd want that to happen. And it's not that way at all. But it is the whole story from another perspective. And then within that whole story from another perspective, there is a unique and unto itself form. And the unique and unto itself form of the seven trumpets is that there are four, which describe the fall of the world, and then three more, which tell the salvation story from fall to salvation. And that between them, you have this hinge point that is not an angel or a trumpet, which is some crazy talk. We'll come back to that again. But I want to emphasize now, and I wish I could draw for you this, because I think it would make more sense. And I'm still not sure that I'm even drawing it right. But if you just write, I'm going to describe it, put it in your head, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4. Write that down, 1, 2, 3, 4. And then put a circle around the 3. And think of that 3 as being in the middle of the 1, 2, 3, 4 on purpose, not at the end. We'd want it at the end because it's like the thing that's going to continue, but it's in the middle because in the ancient world, the middle is what matters. The center is what matters. It's in the middle. And think of it like a rock going into a pond and making a little splash, a little bloop, right? And then what comes from it is the ripple that goes out. And that ripple that goes out is 5, 6, and 7. So 1, 2, 3, 4 are their own. Circle 3, and then 3 expands to 5, 6, and 7. There's nothing in the text that tells you that. This is just what I think. Yeah. What is clear that the text does tell you is there's a distinction between 1, 2, 3, 4 and 5, 6, 7. How am I making the case then that 3 and 5, 6, 7 are one and the same thing? Well, it's not just random. I'll promise you that. It's there in the text. And we touched on it last time, but I'm not sure I said it so well. So here, just put these three verses in your pipe and smoke them. Revelation 8, verse 10 says, "The third angel blew his trumpet, and a great star fell from heaven, blazing like a torch." Right? You got that part? All right. Third trumpet, star falls from heaven. Revelation 9, verse 1, "And the fifth angel blew his trumpet, and I saw a star fallen from heaven to earth." Catch that? It's like the same thing, right? Right. So that's the fifth trumpet. So now you got the fifth and the third are the same. Now hang tight. if you skip all the way ahead to Revelation chapter 12, verse 7, past the part where in Revelation 11, verse 15, the seventh angel blows his trumpet and there's a lot of voices in heaven talking about how the kingdom of God has come, you then see a war arise in heaven. Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fighting back, but the dragon is defeated, and there is no longer any place for them in heaven. And 12 verse 9, the great dragon was thrown down. He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. Does it sound familiar? So now you've got this language about the one who falls from heaven in trumpet 3, trumpet 5, and trumpet 7, the final trumpet. So what about trumpet 6? Well, in trumpet 6, you do have someone coming down from heaven. Another mighty angel comes down, wrapped in a cloud with a rainbow over his head, his face shining like the sun, his legs pillars of fire. This is the guy who puts his feet on the land and the sea. So now, remember our ripple, that the star fallen from heaven in the third trumpet ripples out to be the devil himself committing his fall in the fifth trumpet, which starts the story of the beginning of the world to the end of the world as a whole through 5, 6, 7. He commits his fall then. His fall is completed with the victory over him at the end. And then the middle is the one who achieves the victory. So the devil comes down to earth, and Jesus comes down to earth and, well, destroys him. I wanted to say it differently, but I'm going to be polite today. Destroys him. And now, having been cast down to earth, he knows his time is short. So that 7 like sums up the remainder. In the midst of this, we're going to get three other kind of major descriptions of it, but they're all connected. So you're going to move from the two witnesses that know this prophecy and know this history, Old and New Testament saints. You're going to move through the angel again, who comes down, the incarnation of the Almighty One. And then you're going to move through the parable, the story of the woman and the dragon. What happens to us now as we believe in this and wait upon this? I think that structure is right. Now, I reserve the right to change my mind, and I give you the right to not agree with me and to try to change my mind. But good luck. It is a doozy. Now, one might ask then, Pastor Fisk, how can you say that it all starts then in the fifth trumpet? Right, and that's where the verse today becomes so important, that you have these first four in which the ripple is begun as third angel blows his trumpet, great star falls from heaven, blazing like a torch, falls on the third of the rivers, his name is Wormwood. Many people die. That gets expanded in 5, 6, and 7. How can you say that that's different? Isn't it all just in order? And the answer is no, because Revelation 8:13 puts a stick in the middle of it all and says we're changing directions here. Now, what Brighton says in his commentary is that we're changing from earthly curses to demonic curses. Earthly curses to demonic curses. And there's something perhaps understandable about that. I think I bought that the first time I read it, because what gets ruined in the first four trumpets? You got the green grass and the trees, right? So plants. You got the things of the sea, so things that live in water. You've got things of the streams and people. Okay, so fresh water, that's number 3. But see, that's a little odd that he repeats water, right? There's something off there. And then you got number 4, the lights in the heavenly places, right? The sun, the moon, the stars. So, okay, yeah, those are all created things. But like, when you have hail that is fire mixed with blood falling upon the earth, I mean, it just that's just not normal. That's not natural, right? When a third of the sea becomes blood, it's just supernatural stuff going on here. When wormwood makes many die of the bitter water, it's not just natural, right? So I don't think the distinction here is from you know, non-demonic to demonic. And then doubly so, the fact that this angel, excuse me, the star falling from the sky, blazing like a torch, the third trumpet, is the same language. A star falling from heaven, given the key to the bottomless pit. Well, that means that the demonic's on the other side as well. So that's where I'm going to disagree with him. I'm going to say this is not just creation versus or material creation versus spiritual creation. I don't think so. I think this is expansion, and I think 8:13 is there to say, now let the reader understand. Pay more careful attention to what is said. Now, the thing is then, though, what is said is weird. Not so much what he says, it's who says it. It's who says it. So back, this is all prelude right now. We're back to it. 8:13, Revelation. Then I looked, and I heard an eagle crying with a loud voice as it flew directly overhead. An eagle? Like, what? Why an eagle? And of course, if you are proud to be an American, well, obviously the eagle's the greatest bird there ever was, so why wouldn't he choose an eagle? But see, that's a really new idea. You know, I mean, it's not like people hated eagles, but you know what the word eagle in Greek can mean or means? It's the same word. Vulture. I'm not kidding. Vulture. It's the same word. I heard a vulture crying with a loud voice. Not quite the same ring to it, does it? I did a little Wikipedia on this. They're the same family of bird, by the way. Connected to each other. Evolution is stunning to show the great diversity of this family of hooked beak birds. That is really small, really large. They eat different diets, but it's the marvel of evolution. The eagle and the vulture are, in fact, not only biblically, I'll come back to that, but scientifically, they are tied to each other. They are similar birds. Biblically, follow this. I don't want to say nonsense is not, and logic, well, it is, but it's incredible to me, given how stupid the ancients were and how they don't understand such marvelous things like evolution, that they would know this. They would know what modern science has affirmed, that the eagle and the vulture are the same bird. Not the same bird, but the same family of bird. Leviticus 11, verse 13 says this. It says, "And these you shall detest among the birds. They shall not be eaten. They are detestable. The eagle, the bearded vulture, the black vulture, the kite, the falcon of any kind." He goes on to talk about other things. The ostrich, the raven. Actually, the ostrich might still be part of this too. I can't remember from Wikipedia. I think it's wrong. But they are linked there right off the bat as hook-nosed birds, yeah, that feast upon animals. That's what you're not supposed to eat as a Hebrew of Hebrews. Now, I'm not going to hang my hat on that at all, but it should actually come back to this, proud to be an American, eagles are the greatest thing ever, right? So God chooses an unclean bird to be his voice flying through the sky? An unclean thing? Now, granted, New Testament, we know God's made all things clean again. But still, it's like saying he had a pig do it, right? You don't see a lot of pigs preaching the gospel. You don't see a pig, this is interesting. You don't see a pig represented directly in the throne room of God. But see, you do see an eagle there. And that's where it's not just as easy as the unclean bird. Remember that in the book of Revelation, when John sees the cherubim, who I still think are the seraphim. God bless you if you disagree with me. The cherubim, seraphim, flaming fire, one living creatures around God's throne, who are the intercessors, the unseen intercessors of creation itself, the beings whose life is to be the link between the angelic and the earthly, who represent us all in their ever-present praise and prayer to God, holy, 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 as they sing, on behalf of man, on behalf of bird, on behalf of beast of the field, on behalf of beast of the wild. Well, the one that's there for the birds, right, is the eagle. And we translated eagle because no one likes to think about the vulture, because the vulture is a pretty ugly bird, and the eagle's definitely prettier, no question. But so catch that in Revelation, then, you have this bird that's in there amongst not unclean things, right? The ox, man, lion. I don't know. I don't think lion's prohibited from being eaten in the Old Testament. I should look that up. Not gonna right now. But So the eagle is not all bad, but this is why it's so weird. This is the riddle. This is why there are four things I do not understand. Actually, one, the eagle. Revelation 8:13 doesn't make any sense. And you can look up a bunch of verses about eagles, and there's all sorts. It's all over the map. And I'm gonna share them with you. There's not that many references to it. There's plenty, but the thing that's frustrating, that's riddling, is how there is no consistency with them. There are all sorts of different kinds of things. So in Jeremiah chapter 49, there is a prophecy against Edom. This is the descendants of Esau. And we're not going into all the depth of the context of this. But in the midst of God saying that he's going to destroy them, God says to them through Jeremiah, "Gather yourselves together and come against her and rise up for battle. For behold, I will make you small among the nations, despised among mankind. The horror you inspire has deceived you, and the pride in your heart, you who live in the clefts of the rock, who hold the height of the hill. Though you make your nest as high as the eagles, I will bring you down from there, declares the Lord." So what's the eagle there representing? The eagle is one who is competent to avoid destruction. Yeah, able to stay out of the way of what attack. And God says to Edom, well, even though you have that, like the eagle, you can't hide from me. In Obadiah chapter 1, a prophecy against or concerning Edom. And I don't know the connection of these two, but I got to imagine they are connected historically. He says this. He says, "Rise up, let us rise against her for battle. I will make you small among the nations." Sounds familiar, doesn't it? "You should be utterly despised. The pride of your heart has deceived you, you who live in the clefts of the rock, in your lofty dwelling, who say in your heart," something new here, "who will bring me down to the ground?" And now, it's not about your nest, but it's about the eagle. "Though you soar aloft like the eagle, far off in the sky, though you soar aloft like the eagle, though your nest is set among the stars, from there I will bring you down." Now, don't miss here. I mean, the eagle in Revelation is not the devil, but don't miss that the one he's speaking to puts his nest in the stars, and those stars and him are going to be cast down. Now, that should sound a little bit familiar as well, right? But what's the eagle doing here again? The eagle is an image of inaccessibility. If anyone is safe, the eagle is safe. In Jeremiah 48, so this is before the prophecy against Edom, he describes God's wrath against Moab. And he says that one shall fly swiftly like an eagle and spread his wings against Moab. So here the eagle is becoming an instrument of speed, right? So we got safety and we've got speed. And those are both symbolic uses of the eagle, right? The eagle is standing for an idea there. There's two other verses that are a little less symbolic. I mean, they still are, but they describe sort of the biblical view of the eagle, how the ancient Hebrew would understand an eagle. One is the book of Job, chapter 8, verse 26. And honestly, I didn't even bother to go and look and see if this is one of his friends or not. Nope, it's Job. Job is speaking. But it really doesn't matter for what's being said. I mean, you get that, right? Like, you shouldn't quote Job's friends for their theology, like Rick Warren does in The Purpose-Driven Life a couple times. Don't do that. You're quoting liars. But if you're trying to understand the way that they would understand the world or the way using words, that's a different thing, so it doesn't really matter. But in either case, here's the verse, right? Job says this. He says, "My days are swifter than a runner. They flee away. They see no good. They go by like skiffs of reed, like an eagle swooping on the prey." So he's saying, my life's going to over, right? I'm dying too young. Everything's been ruined. And then he uses the eagle as an example of, again, speed. So it's the same thing as we just established. But it does connect the speed to being one who preys on others, one who is dangerous. And that's interesting because before this, it's been the eagle is just safe on his own. But now Job shows us the eagle is dangerous. And you knew this, right? But it's good to establish it, that the scriptures saw it too. Because none of this has said the eagle's noble, right? None of this is said that the United States is going to be the great kingdom or something like that. Proverbs 23, 4, and 5 says this, do not toil to acquire wealth. Now, I'm just going to let that sink in for a sec. I need to hear it. Do not toil to acquire wealth. Don't work for money. Be discerning enough to desist. Right? Sufficient for the day is its own trouble. If you have bread for the day, we are content. How rare, right? You don't think that. No, you don't. Don't lie. But that's what the proverb says. Be discerning enough to desist. When your eyes light on it, it is gone, the wealth. The wealth is gone the moment you have it. For suddenly it sprouts wings, flying like an eagle toward heaven. So now the eagle is being used as an example of escape, again, being out of reach, something you cannot get to. And of course, the proverb is teaching you that even should you amass billions and billions of dollars, soon enough you're going to be dead and you can't touch it, does you no good. And you will have missed a whole lot of life while you're off chasing what? Pot of porridge, effectively. But the eagle again now, so safety, we're back on safety. Safety and speed. Now the next few verses all kind of have the same driving direction. And I don't think that they're away from safety and speed, but they're really taking on a different route. Up to this point, none of the texts have ever been the eagle as God's salvation, right? You've had the eagle as God's judgment, as an example of the speed of it, or how you can't escape it, right? But now, these next verses are going to be the eagle as various examples of God in his saving acts. So in Deuteronomy chapter 32, verses 7 and following, God is recounting for them how he has saved them, the Hebrews, out of the land of Egypt. And he tells them, remember the ancient times, consider generations ago, ask your father, and he'll tell you what he was told, that the Most High divided mankind and fixed the borders of all peoples and chose in those borders to set a portion for himself who is Jacob, who is Israel. This Jacob, this deceiver, now it's not just Jacob or it's Isaac, it's Abraham, it's Noah, it's Adam, it's all of us fallen. But this Jacob, he found him in a desert land and in the howling wastes of the wilderness, he encircled him. He cared for him. He kept him as the apple of his eye. Like an eagle that stirs up its nest, that flutters over its young, spreading out its wings, catching them, bearing them on its pinions, the Lord alone guided him. No foreign god was with him. He made him ride on the high places of the land, and he ate the produce of the field, and he suckled him with honey out of the rock and oil out of the flinty rock, curds from the herd and milk and fat of lambs, the very finest of wheat, and he drank the foaming wine made from the blood of the grape. Well, I mean, you're mixing your metaphors a little bit there, Moses. But the idea is plenty and bounteousness. So that as an eagle would care for its own young, protecting the young, defending the nest, providing food, so God has done for Israel to the level of extreme wealth. And this use of the eagle there as protector, this is going to come back again. Well, I guess before, I suppose, it's already been established in Exodus chapter 19, verse 4. Whereupon, arriving at Mount Sinai, the Lord calls to Moses out of the burning mountain. He says, thus shall you say to the house of Jacob, the people of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey/hear my voice, keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession amongst all peoples, amongst all nations. So what he says in Deuteronomy is really based on this, not so much in the substance of the eagle, but in the substance of them being chosen, his portion out of the nations. And again, don't miss this. Who's the chosen portion? It's Jesus. He's choosing them as a people through whom Jesus will come, that he might choose all people for himself. So don't miss this. Don't go dispensationalist on me. But the eagle here is, again, being used as an image of salvation, as on eagle's wings. But that gets back to safety, right? Being able to pull one up out of danger and into safety. In Psalm 103, verse 5, you have a very unique, actually, use of the eagle here. Bless the Lord, O my soul, bless his holy name. Forget not his benefits, who forgives your iniquity and heals your disease and redeems your life from the pit and crowns you with steadfast love and mercy and satisfies you with good so that your youth is renewed like the eagles. And what does that mean? Your youth is renewed like the eagles. It has to do with molting. That the eagle sheds its feathers and regrows them and looks fresh and new. And this happens on a regular basis. So you can see a bird that looks old, that within a month or two, I don't know how long it takes, within or maybe it's a week, I don't know, but within a short amount of time, the same bird will look much younger. And it's not like it died and got, it's not the phoenix, right, where it died and rose again, but it's kind of like that. It's like the real phoenix. And that renewing of life is what the Lord does for you. So now the eagle, for the first time, is sort of an image of us in a good way, yeah? An image of resurrection. And that's pretty cool for an unclean animal, for an unclean bird. I'm not sure it has anything to do with Revelation 8:13, but we only got one more verse to look at before we go to what might have something to do with it. I'm still not sure. But in Isaiah chapter 40, verse 31, I'm sure you know this, and it's the same idea here a little bit. They that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. Those who wait upon the Lord, those who are trusting in the Lord, will again have eagle's wings that are running without fainting, right? A renewing of life. So now you're back to safety. We've left the speed behind, right? You had speed, you have safety, and you have renewing. And those are all things that the eagle kind of is an image of. And from what I can tell, those are all things that have nothing whatsoever to do with 8:13 in Revelation. I mean, I'll read it again for you. Then I looked and I heard an eagle crying with a loud voice as it flew directly overhead. Woe, woe, woe to those who dwell on this earth at the blast of the other trumpets that the three angels are about to blow. Right, so let's take those ideas here, and we'll try to fit them in. We'll see if they fit. Then I looked, and then I heard an eagle who's really fast, and so he was going really fast across the sky, crying with a loud voice as he flew directly overhead. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Okay, sure, it's a fast eagle. Then I looked, and I heard an eagle who's very safe. No one could get to him. He was so far away that he was safe as he said, whoa, whoa, whoa to us. Yeah, okay. Then I looked and I heard an eagle who had freshly been molted and had new feathers. And so he was like alive as he cried out to us, whoa, 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 to those who dwell on the earth. I mean, right? There's just not much there. And this is what brings us back to the riddle. It's like, what's going on here, God? John, what's going on here? And it's so riddling that the early, not commentators, but they are, the early copiers of scripture, those who would take texts and make copies and take texts and make copies, and this eventually became a profession, but initially it was done by those who just were doing it. Sometimes you gotta put yourself in their shoes. Like, you got a copy of a book, you've heard it preached before, you've heard it read before, but here's a copy of it, and you're going to make another copy of it, or you're paying to have another copy made of it. Maybe you're paying someone who's not even a Christian, but you know they're really good at being a scribe. And they're coming along, and they see something in the text that looks like a mistake. It looks like a typo, right? What do you do in that moment? When you find a typo in your Bible, what do you do? I know what you would do if you found a typo in your Bible. You would tell the publisher and ask them to give you a Bible without the typo in it, right? Well, this is like back before it was that easy, and there were a lot fewer copies, but they did the same thing. They fixed the typo in the new copy. The problem is that sometimes it wasn't a typo. Sometimes you just weren't understanding it. We're not talking about like one letter out of place. Here we're talking about one word out of place. But think about this. I mean, this is like a really big word out of place. every delivery of every message from God to man in the book of Revelation, if it is not the voice of Jesus or the Father himself, comes from an angel. Every single one. Except for this one right here. And then this one right here sounds a whole lot like Revelation chapter 14, verse 6. I'm going to put them beside each other again. I hope I'm not reading 8:13 too many times for you here, but I want you to hear it. You can't look at it. Maybe you are. Good for you. But if you're driving or something, right, you just have to hear it. Then I looked, and I heard an eagle crying with a loud voice as it flew directly overhead, "Woe, woe, woe to those who dwell on the earth." Revelation 14:6. Then I saw another angel flying directly overhead with an eternal gospel to proclaim to those who dwell on the earth. Sounds pretty similar, doesn't it? So later in the book, you got an angel doing this thing. And all the way through the book, you got angels doing the talking. And so you're some first century person, paid or unpaid, who's here to make a good exact copy of the Holy Script. And you come to this point and you go, well, that looks like somebody just, you know, Jimmy, he's so funny. He likes to go in and change words. Aw, he thought it'd be funny to put an eagle in here and see if I caught it, right? I don't know how it happened. But what happened was that you have a tradition arise, which is pretty significant and really influences the entire Latin tradition, the Vulgate. We're talking about the Bible that Rome still kind of uses, right? That entire tradition is affected by this, so that Revelation 8:13 in those texts does not read, "I heard an eagle." It reads, "I heard an angel." And I'll tell you what, if that's what it said, it'd be so much easier. I wouldn't even be bothering with this part. The last 40 minutes, we would have just gone straight in. Look, the angel said it here. Let's talk about the woes, right? But there's another rule about, and this rule makes sense. It's not universal. It's not like from God, right? But when you're dealing with ancient texts and you have this issue of variants in the manuscript that are connected to human typos, that's effectively what they are. Whether intentional or not, there are discrepancies, and you got to figure out what the real one is. And there's a rule, which it makes a lot of sense. It's a very logical rule. It's that if you have two discrepancies or a discrepancy that cannot be explained by something as simple as like a letter drop, right? So, you know, when you're copying sometimes, or maybe you'll do this when you're reading. I do this when I'm reading scripture in church. My eyes will drop down one line and out of my mouth will come the first letter of a word from that line. Then I finish the word that I'm actually supposed to be saying, right? And so instead of, I don't know, night, I'll say snite because I saw the word shape or something below it, right? It's very common if you do copying work at all, very common. So those kinds of things can be explained pretty, oh, I see where this mistake came from. But if you're in a situation where you can't explain where it came from, there is no similarity between the word, not really, a similarity between the word angel and the word eagle / vulture in the Greek. They don't look the same. So it's not like it was just like an oops. It's a really big difference. And if you see that there's that kind of a thing, and one of the ones makes sense, like an angel makes sense here, and one of them doesn't, the eagle doesn't make sense, it is the rule that you would prefer the one that doesn't make sense. And here's why. It does make sense that someone coming along finds the typo of eagle and changes it to angel. What doesn't make sense, what you cannot explain, really, except for my little Jimmy parable, which is very unlikely, right? What you cannot explain is how someone comes along and they're copying and they see, "I heard an angel crying with a loud voice," and they go, "You know what? I think that's a mistake. I think it's supposed to say eagle there. I'll put eagle in." Like, no one's going to do that. So that means it's probably originally there. And this fits then with the manuscript evidence that it is the oldest and best manuscripts that say eagle, and it's the more recent ones, the translations, the Latin ones, that say angel. So it all fits, unfortunately, to make it so that here we are, stuck with the riddle of the eagle. Have I even begun to help? I'm not sure. But there's one more Old Testament verse that we haven't looked at. And I'm trying something a little different here. I haven't looked at it. I glanced at it. But I haven't, I'm like, oh, well, maybe, ooh, that might go somewhere. And so I went and I got my Kyle and Dalich off the shelf, and you're going to love it, right? I mean, who has been our teacher in the book of Revelation? Do you remember? I mean, if you're new to this, you don't know. You should go back and listen to the Revelation stuff. By the way, it's the best stuff I've done. I mean, Echo, the book Echo is probably the best thing I've ever done. After that, the Revelation series on this podcast is the absolute work of my life. So if you haven't heard them, go hear them. If it's too boring for you to listen while you're running on your treadmill, don't run on your treadmill and listen to it. Don't. Do it while you're doing something else that's got your mind attended to it, right? I like to listen to Hardcore History while I play video games. Not games where I have to like think or talk, right? But just my mind's active. Do something with your hands, you know? Anyhow, so, you know, if you've listened before, you know who Kyle and Dalich are, right? That they are the Old Testament commentary that I rely on for the general structure of most Old Testament books and their history and their context, even though they're a little dated, which is fair. But who have we found again and again to be our teacher explaining the text of Revelation? You got to know by now, right? It's been Ezekiel over and over again. Now, Daniel's big and Isaiah's big, but it has been Ezekiel. Over and over again. And wouldn't you know it, that there is a to-do with an eagle in the book of Ezekiel, chapter 17. But here's the thing. I've set you up, and I don't know. I haven't done the research yet. We're going to do it right now together, or I'm going to do it as I speak it to you. We're going to find out if we don't find something. Oh, man. 10 minutes left? I don't know if we can ever make it. And here's the challenge, though. Here's why I didn't just read it on my own. It's because as soon as I went to Ezekiel chapter 17, which on page 236 of my copy of Kyle and Dalich, they titled The Humiliation and Exaltation of the Davidic Family, I realized that that's important, and it has a context. It has something that came before it, because what we've seen with the prophets in general, rarely do they obey chapter breaks, right? Rarely do they tie up nicely so that each chapter is like its own prophecy standing by itself. They're connected either thematically or as like a whole, like they will run through several chapters. So I'm like, okay, well then, what's chapter 16? Because I mean, as much as I've been teaching this to you, I don't know this stuff. I'm not a master of this stuff. It's not stuck in my head. God knows I wish it was. So I don't know where Ezekiel 17 fits in the big picture of Ezekiel. So I look back and I see chapter 16. Ingratitude and unfaithfulness of Jerusalem, its punishment and shame. Okay, well, That seems like it's still building on something that had to have come before it. So I hop back to 15. Jerusalem, the useless wood of a wild vine, which I'm like, okay, that doesn't mean anything. Except for then, as I was moving along, I realized that chapter 17 is going to deal with Jerusalem, a vine. And here we are now, the wild vine back in 15. So let's see, it's going to hang together. Well, okay, well, how do we get to Jerusalem, the wild, the useless vine? Well, chapter 14... they call attitude of God toward the worshipers of idols. Well, that would explain why someone is useless to God. They're worshiping idols. Now we're starting to get somewhere making sense. Chapter 13, it's against the false prophets, which would be those who preach the idolatry, right? But we're still waiting for, like, where's this thing start? Chapter 12, the departure of the king and the people and the bread of tears. Chapter 12, then, is the historical account via prophecy. So it's being told as a future, but it is something that actually happened, of the fulfillment of the prophecy that sits from chapters. Now I'm flipping, trying to find it here. I don't know where it starts. Sorry. I don't want to stop the recorder. Come on. Chapters 8 through 11, which are one total picture of the destruction of Jerusalem. Okay, so now we got somewhere we can start. Ezekiel is already an exile in Babylon. He's receiving visions from God about the crazy stuff going on in Jerusalem. Remember, like the cultic worship underneath the temple, which it's symbolic. But remember, you know, the Sherlock Holmes kind of stuff from quite a few episodes ago. So he's seen all that. And then chapters 8 through 11, he sees a total picture of God's reaction to this. The glory of the Lord's already departed, right? He has left the temple, and what's going to happen next is this massive destruction of the temple. Chapter 12, then, gives us the physical fallout of that, that the king who remains, the heir to David's line, and all the people have to eat the bread of tears. They have to, you know, the Native American Trail of Tears, same idea. They've got to walk to Babylon as slaves. And that as they're doing this, they're still being preached to by the false prophets. The false prophets won't go away. They keep saying that this is not God's work, that God didn't do this to you. Golly, and that reminds me of something, right? I mean, I remember a lovely lady, member of a parish, who was really disturbed when I said in Bible study that God is the one who is sending and controlling death in the world. She wanted to say, I thought it was the devil. And the answer is like, well, the angel of death may or may not be the devil. Certainly is in league and in working with the devil. Certainly is an enemy who will be destroyed. But please make no mistake that death comes as a punishment which God sends. And the reason she didn't like that is she wanted to protect God. She wanted God to stay happy. She wanted a happy God who does loving things, not a mad God who does wrathful things. And so she wanted me to preach that all the bad stuff was from the devil and all the good stuff is from God. And I don't think she quite understood that. I'm not mad at her about it. But it's very common, this sort of Hallmark-style pious devotion, which is a total lie. It's what the false prophets of old would say to the king. No, God didn't do this to you. You're the heir to David's throne. Don't listen to that prophet Ezekiel who's telling you that this is your doing and that you must repent or it will be yanked from you. All right, so that's 13. So then 14 just kind of continues that thought. So, okay, so the false prophets are false prophets, but you know what? If you listen to them, God's attitude toward you is certain judgment. You don't get to escape just because you were deceived. The curse still comes upon you. In fact, honestly, truth be told, you've chosen to be deceived. You prefer to be deceived, which is why you, Jerusalem, chapter 15, are a useless wood of a wild vine. Your ingratitude and your unfaithfulness, chapter 16, is its own punishment and its own shame. So you own and you deserve and you need the humiliation that you are as David's people. And wouldn't you believe it that the best way that God has to explain this is with a riddle about an eagle. No, I'm not kidding. It's a riddle about an eagle. Chapter 17. I'm going to read the Kyle Dalitz translation. The word of Jehovah came to me, saying, Son of man, give a riddle and relate a parable to the house of Israel. And say, Thus saith the Lord Jehovah. A great eagle with great wings and long pinions full of feathers of variegated colors came to Lebanon and took the top of the cedar. He plucked off the topmost of its shoots and brought it into Canaan's land. In a merchant's city, he set it. And he took of the seed of the land and put it into seed land. Took it away to many waters, set it as a willow. And it grew and became an overhanging vine of low stature. And its branches might turn toward him. And its roots might be under him. And it became a vine and produced shoots and sent out foliage. There was another great eagle with great wings and many feathers. And behold, this vine stretched its roots languishly toward him and extended its branches toward him that he might water it from the beds of its planting. It was planted in a good field by many waters to send out roots and bear fruit to become a glorious vine. Say, thus saith the Lord Jehovah, will it thrive? Will they not pull up its roots and cut off its fruit so that it withereth? All the fresh leaves of its sprouting will wither. And not with strong arm and with much people will it be possible to raise it up from its roots. And behold, although it is planted, will it thrive? Will it not wither when the east wind touches it? Upon the beds in which it grew, it will wither. Whoa, whoa, whoa. To those who dwell on the earth, at the blast of the other three trumpets that the three angels are about to blow. Now, look, I'm not going to leave you there. We're going to, it's an hour. We're done. I'm going to go and I'm going to read up on what that meant. And that's where we're going to start next week. Next time we pick this up, we're going to be looking at, what did that mean? What is that riddle? Because I think if anyone's going to help us here, it's going to be Kyle and Dale explaining that riddle from Ezekiel. And we're going to try to pull it back, pull it all back to Revelation.
Was that worth a dollar? What about five? If so, Pastor Fisk and his family would love to have it, in part to pay for technology and paperwork to keep Rev Fisk Raw going, and in part to just enjoy a night out together. Pledging $1.25 on Patreon, only $5 a month, lets the worker know his labor is appreciated. And if you're a true fan, you can give even more. You can find the link to Patreon in the show notes. And check out the other giving levels there, including advertising your product, your family, or your congregation on Rev Fisk Raw. Lock and load, then rock on.